We're live? There we are. Now we're live. Good evening, everybody. Ron Partain, Untold History. It is Tuesday night, which means it's everybody's favorite night because it's Tuesdays with Mike. How you doing there, Mr. King?
Ron and friends, greetings. Good to be with you again.
As always. Yes, sir. The
weeks just fly by.
Indeed they do, don't they? It's just it's hard to believe that it's already basically the year's over, half over. Yeah. We're coming into the seventh month. So nuts. But we're not talking about that today. We're actually talking about the buildup of World War II in the Asian Pacific theater. And then we're probably going to cross over and then touch on some of the things that happened, getting into the beginning of World War II, at least in the Pacific theater, the Asian Pacific theater. All right. So, Mr. King, it's all you, the floor is yours, sir.
You know, normally when we talk about World War II, it's always, you know, Europe and Hitler and Churchill, what's going on over there. The war in the Asian Pacific with Japan is kind of ancillary, but it should get more print than it does because it was also world changing and very deadly. It was a big story going on over there. Just not as I guess there's not a personality of the magnitude of Hitler, so maybe we don't talk about it as much, but we should. And so that's what I want to focus on, just the Asian Pacific element of World War II. And the connection is Japan was allied in the defense anti-communist pact with Germany, also Italy. So, you know, that's kind of what links everything together.
Right.
But, you know, as is the case with all big events, there's always a long progression of lesser events occurring at regular intervals, going back even decades before you get to the big event itself. Okay. So I wanted to start tonight's story, believe it or not, in 1853. There's an event that I want to touch upon, and I think will add clarity to World War II in the Asian Pacific when we get to that point 90 years later. But 1853 is when the United States, which already now had politicians who were coming under the influence of the Rothschilds. President Millard Fillmore sent Commodore Perry over to Japan. It's called gunboat diplomacy, as I refer to it. And actually, at the point of a gun, the Japanese were forced to open up their economy and their society, and then begin modernizing. Now, there were some people in Japan who wanted that too, so it wasn't like a conquest, but it was gunboat diplomacy. Probably, I mean, with the exception of Jefferson's military action against the Barbary pirates, this would really be the first foreign adventure by the U.S. military, the opening up of Japan. And here he is, it's Commodore Perry. And it's interesting, he is related by marriage to Senator John Slidell of Louisiana. Hmm. Okay. Well-known Confederate Senator John Slidell, who is related by marriage through a daughter who's married to Commodore Slidell, but his niece is married to Erlanger, who was a Rothschild banker. And then he had another daughter married to August Belmont, who was an agent of the Rothschilds. His real name was Schoenberg. In 1860, became chairman of the Democrat Party. So Slidell is related three different directions to people who are directly connected to the Rothschild dynasty. Wow.
I want to ask a question. Did you say Belmont or Beaumont? B-E-L or B?
August Belmont.
So B-E-L.
The Belmont Stakes race.
Okay.
Horse race is named after.
Because I wanted to make sure you were.
Schoenberg. His real name is August Schoenberg from Prussia, a Prussian Jew.
No problem.
Sent there by the Rothschilds.
I was just trying to make sure that it wasn't Beaumont from like Beaumont, Texas.
Oh, no, no. Belmont, August Belmont. And okay. He actually became chairman of a Democrat Party. But so you see all these connections to this mission to open up China. And it was from that moment on that China began industrializing. And there's a reason for it, because the Rothschilds wanted China one day to take on the country that they hated most, which was the Russian Empire, Romanov Russia. So that's why they built up China. It was Rothschild agents opened up China in 1853 for that specific purpose of fighting Russia. So now let's fast forward. Let's jump ahead about 50 years. The Russo-Japanese War, 1905. So in less than a half century, Japan has been transformed from basically like a medieval feudalistic society to an industrial power capable of fighting Russia. And that's what they were built up for. And they went to war with Russia. Their best ships were built over in Liverpool. Theodore Roosevelt, we now know this in a fact, it's all laid out in my book, Teddy the Terrible, about Teddy Roosevelt, which you could get at realnewsandhistory.com. But it was the British, Teddy Roosevelt, who was under the influence of Jacob Schiff, the Rothschild Syndicate, pushing Japan to make war with Russia. And there's even cartoons from the day in Russian newspapers. Shows a little Japanese guy with a sword in his hand. And it's Roosevelt and John Bull, who symbolizes Britain, pushing him to fight Russia. And Jacob Schiff financed much of the Russo-Japanese War with big loans to Japan. After the war, Japan gave him an honor. They gave him a special medal that no foreigner ever got to Jacob Schiff. And this was the pretext. This is what the map looked like in Asia back in those days. But Russian Empire controlled Manchuria up here, north of the Koreas. But that was historically Chinese. So Japan fought Russia. The war is going on. Teddy Roosevelt intervenes. It's called the Treaty of Portsmouth. But he doesn't intervene militarily. He intervenes like, as you know, he's the president of an up-and-coming power that just got bases in the Philippines, Spanish-American War. And he plays the role of peacemaker. He was actually awarded the 1905 Nobel Peace Prize for this. But he was engineering the war. He was on Japan's side the whole time. Now he presents himself as an objective negotiator. But he tilts the treaty in Japan's favor, and they get Manchuria. And here's a cartoon from the day showing Teddy making peace between the Russian Tsar and the Japanese. Okay, but he was serving the interests of Rothschild and Schiff, working against Russia. Now, concurrently with this, the dissatisfaction with the war of 1905 was used by the Bolsheviks to launch the first Bolshevik Revolution. They fell short, but they greatly weakened Russia. Okay, so now we have some context of what's going on. Japan is the Japanese Empire, with its industrial might, is a creation of the United States and the globalists at this time. And that's why they got Manchuria, and that's why they're present on the continent, and it's also why they were given jurisdiction over the Korea, all by Teddy Roosevelt.
Hmm. And incidentally, when the 1905 Russian Revolution failed, all of the communists that were in Russia, they happened to go to Germany.
Yeah, they fled to Germany, and a bunch came to Brooklyn. Trotsky and his boys came to Brooklyn. They were, you know. They should have been exterminated, rounded up and exterminated. The Tsar was weak. He wasn't brutal enough with them. And some of them even escaped the prison camps. So now we've got some context of what's going on in Asia. So that is how Japan came to have jurisdiction over the Koreas and parts of Manchuria given to them by the globalists. Not out of any love for Japan, of course, all as a a way to tactically maneuver against Russia. And later on, they would sell out Japan as well. So now we can move into the 1930s and see what's going on. I actually pulled this down a few days ago to have some, because I knew that American intelligence assets were active in China, trying to stir up trouble and incite trouble against Japan. They wanted to pit China against Japan. So now that was the new goal. Japan's not our friend anymore. They never were. And Roosevelt even boasted about how we played them in letters to his son. We got Japan to play our game. But this is from CIA.gov. CIA did not exist at that time. And even the OSS, its forerunner, was not established until 1942 during the war. But before that, I guess you'd call it the forerunner of the forerunner, these types of dirty tasks were being run by U.S. Naval Intelligence. Okay. They blew up the USS Maine, by the way. That's how we got at the Spanish-American War. So this is from CIA.gov, Operations in Another Time. In 1969, an old military China hand, Major General William Wharton, described an intelligence operation he undertook from 1935 to 1936. This is 5-6 years before Pearl Harbor, and it's even 2 to 3 years before the war with China breaks out. Okay? So there's nothing going on. There's peace in Asia. And here you have this American intelligence operative. General Wharton felt the operation was so sensitive that he restricted the opening of the transcript until 10 years after his death. So this didn't come out until many years later. His mission is the FDR administration. His mission to recruit and run agents from Shanghai in China into Japan for the Office of Naval Intelligence. And et cetera, et cetera. So Roosevelt, exactly as was the case in Europe, was already stirring up shit in the mid-1930s on both continents. So, what is it that the United States, acting on the behalf of the New World Order globalists, what were they trying to do? Well, they were trying to pit China and Japan against each other in a war.
And more importantly, China was already in kind of a civil war at the time. Because you had the nationalists of Chiang Kai-shek who were fighting against the communists of Mao Zedong.
Well, that's right. And guess who we wanted to put in power? And
that's
guess
right.
Who Stalin wanted? Well, right. Stalin's boy. Here it is right here. Here's Stalin with Mao Zedong. So that was the idea.
But it was...
Nationalist government in China and a nationalist government in Japan. We're both getting along, no problem. You pit one against the other, just like World War I. They put Germany against Russia, they end up taking down both. So that is the geostrategy, the global geostrategy. So now we're adding more, another layer of context before we get to Pearl Harbor. This is stuff that people didn't know then, or they forgot. They sure as hell don't know now. But, you know, once you understand it, I mean, that's what I like to do. I like to set the table before I get to the big show.
I think it should be noted that, you know, even though people don't understand truly what happened in Southeast Asia pre-World War II, it was a very, very big deal. And guess who was in Vietnam? The French. That's why they called it French Indochina. So, the players that were there, and England actually had control of Singapore and Hong Kong as a result of after the end of World War I. So, I mean, there was all sorts of belligerence in there, but, and I'm not trying to take away from anything you're saying. I'm just saying there was a lot of people, a lot of stuff that was going on in Southeast Asia that people have no idea what was going on there. So,
yeah. And it was all the same, governments who by this time are under the influence of the New World Order cabal.
Yep.
UK, France, even the Dutch. and the United States.
Yes.
And there's people in Asia who understood this too. So there, you know, there's kind of like a resentment to some of that stuff. Now, 1936, again, China, Japan, they're getting along, but there is a civil war going on in China. Mao Zedong, the Reds, the communists, being supplied by Stalin, are fighting the nationalist government, anti-communist government of Chiang Kai-shek. Japan is also anti-communist. So at this point in time, there's no way they're going to spread communism, globalism, or democracy, all those globalist systems into Asia. Not when Japan is solid and not when China is solid. Again, sort of like pre-World War I. You had the Tsar, you had the Kaiser. They both had to go. Put them against each other, and eventually took them both down. So that's what they're hoping to achieve, and that's why our pre-CIA, pre-OSS operatives were in Shanghai stirring up trouble. But many people in China, in the Chinese government, were pro-Japanese. They wanted good relationships. Chiang Kai-shek didn't want war. Had no trouble with the Japanese. There's an incident that occurred in 1936. This is something I dug up only last year. And it's truly, it must have been earth-shattering at the time when this news broke. But Chiang Kai-shek, who is the leader, the military dictator, basically, of the most populous country in the world, he's invited by nationalist generals who are fighting the Reds to come and speak to the troops. That was the pretext. Well, he shows up, they kidnap him. Here's the headline. Chiang Kai-shek is prisoner of mutinous Shenxi troops demanding war on Japan. And those are the two generals. That's Chiang on the far end. And those are the two generals who kidnapped him. That's not a picture of the kidnapping. That's a picture from another time. So they tricked him and they kidnapped him. And they wanted war with Japan. It says right there, New York Times headline, demanding war with Japan. And while he's in captivity, they bring in Chou Enlai, one of the communist leaders, to come speak with Chiang. So now I don't have evidence that these generals were in cahoots with the CIA guys or the pre-CIA guys. That's probably a logical inference because that was the whole idea the whole time. But in order to get Japan, to get China to go to war with Japan, you first have to stop the civil war. So he's in captivity for a few weeks, and then they release him. And China is rejoicing. Their leader has been released. But this was the dirty deal that was made. You're going to war with Japan, just like that headline said. And it's only a few months after there was an incident at the Marco Polo Bridge. The Chinese, Manchuria, the Japanese are there. They've been there for decades because Roosevelt put them there. They didn't invade Manchuria. They come into contact with Chinese troops. The Chinese begin firing. It's a relatively minor incident in a battle, but you need that triggering event. You always need that triggering event. And that's how China and Japan were brought to war in 1937. All manipulation and maneuvering by Roosevelt and these generals and the Reds. And the deal was, and Chiang fell for it. I guess he didn't have much choice. The deal was, we're gonna stop fighting, and you're gonna put all the Red troops are gonna be under your command. So he probably figures, okay, well, in time they'll be my people. That was only temporary because I'm getting ahead of myself. But after the war, they're just gonna go back to fighting again.
Was it even after the war that they started again? I thought it was during the war that they started fighting against each other.
Now, during the war, they had to be united.
But
I don't know when they turned on them. Was it actually after the surrender, or maybe towards the end when it was obvious that Japan is finished?
Right. Right.
So I don't know when it actually finished, but for the war or the main bulk of the war itself, they were under Chiang's command. Okay. And here you have Mao and Chiang drinking a toast, burying the hatchet. It was all a trick. So that's how it happened. But China had no intention. But China started the war at the manipulation of FDR and Churchill. So that's how war began over there. And Stalin was clever. He's like, I got to take Japan off the field. Let them be preoccupied with China. Okay? Because I got to take Europe. And Japan is hooked up with Germany. So he's worried about a two-front war. You know? So this was all manipulation and scheming against Japan, which was not the aggressor. And they only ended up on the mainland because we built them up, dating back to Commodore Perry and then later Theodore Roosevelt.
Let me pause you there for a second. I just want to say thank you to SJ for the $50 Rumble rant. Thank you very much. Very appreciative. Thank you. Yeah, good, Mike.
Okay, so what do we have now? We have, so that's the situation there. Japan and China are fighting each other. Perfect. The globalists want to ultimately see them both take each other out. And Stalin's got breathing room because he's scheming against all of Europe. He's got a long-term plan. Okay, now, fast forward now to 1941. Okay, World War II has been going on for a couple of years. The United States is not in. In summer of 1941, Germany, preemptive invasion against the Soviet Union because they were going to take all of Europe.
So that we're clear, the Soviet Union was amassing troops on their Western Front to invade Western Europe in July. And what Mike is saying is that Germany precipitated that invasion by approximately 3 weeks to catch the Russians on their feet, flat-footed rather.
Right, right.
And we know this as we know this as fact because in 1991, when the wall fell, there are documents that prove the Soviet Union was amassing an army and prepared to launch an invasion of Western Europe.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that one. I mean, Hitler was telling the truth, and that's why they captured so many men and so many munitions in such a short amount of time. And they made it all the way to the suburbs of Moscow. So now, as the summer's unfolding, Stalin's in a panic. The Germans are at the gates of Moscow. What happens now if Germany's ally comes in from the west? We're finished. So they really began, through his communist agents, and you know, FDR wanted to save Stalin because he needs a second front because eventually we're going to go into war against Germany. So you got to have the second front. You have to have Soviet Union in there. Otherwise, forget about it.
Right.
So FDR, Stalin, they need to get the United States into the war quick. Otherwise, the whole Soviet Union is going to collapse, and Japan could very well come in from the west, from the east. So at this precise moment in time, they really begin to ratchet up the provocation and the humiliation and the intimidation of Japan. So it's not just through the Chinese proxy. FDR, you have the oil embargo, cutting off the traffic through the Panama Canal, aggressive cruises in and among the Japanese island. They really start arming up the Japanese. There's actually a book here. This is really perfect timing. I haven't read it yet, though, but it just arrived 2 days ago from a reader. And I was perusing it. It's called Operation Snow. And it's from an establishment historian named John Koster, you know, respected, not a conspiracy theorist like Mike King. But the book tells about the Soviet effort through their agents in the Roosevelt administration, in particular, Harry Dexter White, his real name is Weiss, Jewish communist, in the Roosevelt administration to get the U.S. in the war quick. So intense provocation, and the idea was to get Japan to make the first move against the U.S. That gets the U.S. in the war. And even before the U.S. gets in the war, just the fact that Roosevelt was being so aggressive was a relief for Stalin. because now Japan's thinking we're already at war with China. If we pick a fight with the United States, we'll not pick a fight, but if we respond to the United States provocations, you know, it's going to be a problem, but we're certainly not in a position now to go to war against the Soviet Union. So that secured Stalin's rear. Okay.
Where did the Panay fall in that? The Panay boat incident. I know that was in like 1937. So would that have been when they were starting to ramp things up? Because the Japanese attacked that American boat in the Yangtze River. That was 1937. Yeah, I think there's 37.
I hadn't even heard about that 1937, but that would make sense because on the down low, the United States was involved.
The USS Panay.
Maybe it's one of those things that, you know, happens, and it didn't happen because we're not supposed to be there.
So here, I'm just going to look at the this is the Wikipedia reference. The USS Panay was a Japanese bombing attack on the U.S. Navy River gunboat Panay and three Standard Oil Company tankers on the Yangtze River near the Chinese capital of Nanjing on December the 12th of 37. Japan and the United States were not at war at the time. The boats were part of the American naval operation called Yangtze Patrol, which began following the joint British, French, and American victory in the Second Opium War. Public reaction was mixed in the U.S., with the president weighing various diplomatic and military responses, only to settle for an apology and compensation.
Yeah.
Now that's the official.
Some kind of covert operation that they weren't supposed to be involved with. And then, so when the Japanese respond to it, you can't acknowledge it, and they probably just put it under the rug. But that's more confirmation of the kind of dirty stuff U.S. Mm-hmm. and the British were doing even before Pearl Harbor in order to prop up China and get China to fight Japan. But that was, did you say 1937? That was the first, that's when the war broke out.
December 12th of 37.
Yeah, so that's the first year the war broke out after Chiang's kidnapping. So clearly, and that's what I'm saying here all along, the United States was propping up China. It was sort of a reversal, like the same way that they were secretly behind the scenes propping up Japan to fight Russia, now it's China to fight Japan. So this provocation continues to 1941. He's got to get us into the war, and it's almost getting to the point now where Roosevelt will just start the war unilaterally if he has to. Okay, because you got the winter in 1941 is approaching, that kind of bought Stalin some time. But what happens after the spring thaw in 1942? Germany will just pick up where they left off. So there's a big hurry to get into the war now. It really kicks into overdrive. Whereas before, it's like, okay, we'll help out the Chinese, keep that war going. Now it's, we got to get in. So that's critical. The German invasion of the Soviet Union kicked the U.S. effort to join the war against Japan into overdrive. It was really because it was a backdoor to get into the war with Germany. The communists were in a panic when Hitler went in. So now, during this period, there's phony talks and phony negotiation. Roosevelt knows he's going to war. And the Japanese already know that he's going to war. So here is a article I pulled out from August 1941, 3 months before Pearl Harbor, 4 months before Pearl Harbor. This is the back pages of the New York Times. Japanese see a Jewish plot. Newspapers today loosed a torrent of abuse against President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill for their war aims declaration, charging that it's part of an intensified campaign to encircle Japan and a Jewish plot. The Jews want bases in the Atlantic and the Pacific, at Burma, bases in China from which to bomb Japan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the Japanese. They knew what was going on. They knew about the New World Order scheme of things. So they knew the war was coming. And who was behind it? Now, we're getting close now. We go to November 1941. I'm sure you're familiar with this quote, the famous quote from the diary of Henry Stimson, Secretary of War. This is November 25th, 1941. Okay, we're just 2 weeks from Pearl Harbor. And he writes, he's talking about their meeting. The question was how we should maneuver the Japanese into position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. Stimson, that's in his diary. Outrageous provocation. Charles Lindbergh and the American First Committee, they saw it. There was something called the Mothers Movement, millions of mothers. Because you know, remember, this is only like 22 years after World War I. So the memory of all the 150,000 dead, and all the other ones who died later on from gas, is still fresh. Country is totally anti-war. So the only way you're going to overcome that is with a false flag. Well, actually, this wouldn't be a false flag. This would be a provocation of Japan to make the first move. So eventually, things got so bad, the Japanese made the calculation that if we strike an early blow against the Americans and the British and even the French and kick everybody out of Southeast Asia, we can take Guam, get the U.S. out of the Philippines, do a little damage at Pearl Harbor, we'll gain an early advantage. So that was the calculation they made, and that's why the Pearl Harbor attack was launched. It was absolutely justifiable, and it was the smart move, given the context, because at least it bought them time. Of course, they didn't want the United States in the war, but FDR made it clear there's going to be war anyway. So there it is.
Kind of like FDR wasn't giving Japan a choice, just like Winston Churchill wasn't giving Hitler a choice.
Yeah, right.
They were imposing war.
Yeah, I mean when it becomes clear that the war is coming, despite the rhetoric, you have to hit first. So I mean that's what Pearl Harbor is, and that's exactly what Roosevelt wanted, as confirmed in the diary of Stimson. And there you go. So when that happened, it was like 9/11 of the day. The country went nuts. Now, this is a country that's 80% opposed to entering the war. The only people who wanted to go into war were Jews, communists, and there were probably a million communists back then, and extreme libtards. 80% of the country, no, absolutely no war. Pearl Harbor hits. Look at the transition. The very next day, young men, young boys, kids 16, 17, lying about their age, showing up at the recruitment office. Millions of them. So now FDR, instead of having to lie, say, no, it's not true. We're not going to war, blah, 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 blah. Now he doesn't even have to sell it. It's a done deal. So that's what Pearl Harbor is all about. So now we've got the whole context going back to the 1800s up until Pearl Harbor. And having framed it in this way, I'd like you to play that little video I showed you.
Sure.
Just so that was coming. We could get an idea and better appreciate what an evil, demonic scumbag Franklin Roosevelt, who remains one of our most.
So should I give the caveat to everybody to listen very closely to the words?
Yeah, I mean this is a famous speech. Probably a lot of people have heard it, but definitely just listen.
Listen very closely.
Stop. Inversion of reality.
Yeah, stop what you're doing and listen to this. Here we go.
December 7th, 1941. A date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost.
as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. But always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God.
Gag. So help us God. It's interesting how these freaking communists always use God when it suits them.
Yeah. Disgusting. Disgusting. Sick, evil bastard. I mean, the whole time. I mean, he had repealed the Neutrality Acts 2 years earlier. He had instituted the draft. That's another point. Almost forgot. A year and a half earlier. And then when the 1 year term was up, he kept those draftees in there because he knew Pearl Harbor was coming. So that's just disgusting. I compare that to George Bush at Ground Zero on 9/11 with the bullhorn. You know, we're going to get him.
Yeah. So
that's how long this evil's been going on. But that's how it was played. Now, everybody was anti-Japanese. Now, surprisingly, the next day, the New York Times, and I would say this is the very last time that you'll find any wartime truth gems in the newspaper. Because up until that point, you could read statements, because we were supposedly neutral, right? You could read statements from the German Foreign Ministry, excerpts from Hitler speeches, etc. But this is from the day after Pearl Harbor. They carried the entire text of the declaration of war from Japanese Emperor Hirohito. And I'm just going to read a little paragraph from it. This is the Emperor of Japan. More than 4 years have passed since China, failing to comprehend the true intentions of our empire and recklessly courting trouble, disturbed the peace of East Asia and compelled our empire to take up arms. The Chinese regime, relying upon American and British protection, continues its fratricidal opposition, eager for the realization of their inordinate ambition to dominate the Orient. Both America and Britain, giving support to China, have aggravated the disturbances in East Asia. It has not been our wishes for our empire to be brought to cross swords with America and Britain. So, and you know, when you match up all the data against each other from that era, treat it like a judge, it's clear. The emperor was telling the absolute truth. Roosevelt was telling absolute falsehoods. So that's how we got into the war.
I'm looking here, and I'm trying to remember when did Stalin bring troops from Siberia westward? Was that in the early 40s, or was that was that in June, or was it not until the winter? Because that was when they finally found out that when Japan attacked the United States because of the Tripartite Pact, Germany declared war on the United States. But
well, it was more of an acknowledgement of war. If you read Hitler's speech, it was like, okay.
That's not where I'm going with that. But the thing is that Japan didn't reciprocate and declare war on Russia.
They had a non-aggression pact. They were with the Soviet Union.
With Japan and Russia?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And that was because Stalin pulled off that trick. So they had a non-aggression pact.
But they also had a non-aggression
pact. It does not mean that they were precluded from coming to Germany's aid, but now they're at war with Britain, United States, China at the same time.
Right.
I think the last thing they wanted on their plate was
the Russians. But if the Soviets were already being weakened, it would have been the perfect time for them to have a war, since they already had the ground troops there. However, that's not really where I'm going with that. I just know that I think there was like 70 divisions out in the west, or in the far east of Russia. And when I think it was the foreign Soviet min or the Soviet minister to Japan, he made it clear that Japan had no intention of going to war with Russia, and therefore Stalin reallocated all those Siberian troops to come west and fight against the Russian, or fight against the Germans. And they were like cold war, or they were cold weather troops that were like prepared to fight in bitter cold. So they threw them against Germany right by the time they got there and got engaged in battle. I mean, it was, Germany was on its heels.
So anyway. Well, Germany would have won anyway if it wasn't for the lend-lease supplies and then the internal.
Agreed. Season,
they still could have won in 1943.
I absolutely agree.
But that was Stalin's game. It's like, it's interesting. And Japan would have no way of knowing this. They probably reckoned after Pearl Harbor, United States is going to come back fast and strong. We didn't. And MacArthur was pissed off about it. It was almost like, we'll get there when we get there. The high priority was to get into North Africa. And even though North African fighting doesn't start till 43, all those troops start arriving in 42, which compels the Germans to start defending Southern Europe, Africa, Northern Europe, because even without the physical American attack, just the fact that they're there opens up a diversion, a second front. So that... It helps Stalin on both ends, because now he's got the Japanese at bay and he frees up some of his own troops. And at the same time, the Germans have to start moving. They got to start thinking, we got to defend out. The Americans are coming. So it was just perfect for him. Okay.
You know, one thing I don't know if I ever told you, this is just a little rabbit hole, and I'm just going to go down for a second, but about an hour, an hour and 10 minutes from me to the east is the Patton Museum, because when he was training to go to North Africa to fight, all of the training that he was doing was in Southern California in the desert, out near 29 Palms and like out past Palms, in between where I am in Arizona. That was where he was training. And there's actually a Patton Museum out there. I've never gone. I need to, I should do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's a lot of patent history out here.
Now the first order of business for the Japanese is they clear out the British from all those there, like Malaysia and Burma. And there's an interesting parallel between the headlines in the United States newspapers regarding the Japanese aggression and the German aggression. In Germany, as we've discussed several times, all the German moves were preemptive. But then when Germany goes into a country, they say, oh, the Nazis invade Holland, the Nazis invade Belgium, the Nazis invade Greece. The same thing with Japan. They go into Burma to kick the British out. And they're welcomed by many people as liberators. Here's the London Daily Express. Japs marching on Burma, land in Philippines. Malaysia. Japs invade Malaysia, bomb Singapore. So, I mean, it's the same pattern. The headlines, the propaganda, the Japanese monster grabbing the white woman there. He's going to rape her, I guess. You know, here's a Jap with his putting his nose in a mouse trap of Alaska, the death trap for the Jap. Okay, they wanted to fortify Alaska. They were leading the public to believe that they were going to invade Alaska. So it was the same exact thing. It's like Germany, only in Asia. The fake atrocity propaganda, the spinning of preemptive necessary military moves into invasions, okay, and that's how it proceeded. And then the rest of the story we pretty much know. The United States has entered a war, and slowly we close in on the Japanese perimeter. But now towards the end of the war, this is where things get really, this is why you can't get in bed with these people. And it happens so many times throughout history. I don't know why these national leaders get in bed with America and Britain. You're only going to get stabbed in the back. But Chiang Kai-shek, who was courted by FDR and Roosevelt, and they had their conferences and so on, completely behind his back at Yalta, Roosevelt and Churchill promised Stalin that he's going to get those ports in Manchuria and jurisdiction over North Korea.
Yep.
All he has to do is 90 days after the war in Europe has ended, he's got to enter the war. Now, Japan thinks they have a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. But here's the Soviet Union at Yalta signed on to attacking Japan 90 days after the war in Europe is over. So Japan's getting betrayed by what they think is the Soviet Union, who is at peace with them. And Chiang is getting sold out because he's induced into the war. He thinks he's going to get Manchuria, and he's not. So exactly 90 days after VE Day in Europe, what happens? Here's a pair of headlines, New York Times. Soviet Union declares war on Japan, attacks Manchuria. Tokyo says, atom bomb loosed on Nagasaki. The same day as Nagasaki, the Soviets joined the war. They didn't even have to get their uniforms dirty. Truman warns Japan, quit or be destroyed. Soviet pincers drive 14 miles into Manchuria.
Well, you know, I never.
Japan is bombed out. They've got no industrial capability. Hiroshima bombed, Nagasaki bombed. And, oh, by the way, the Soviet Union just declared war on us. So it's over.
I never put that together, that it had to be 90 days and that May 8th to August 8th was 90 days. I had never put that together. Holy crap. Boy, that talk about synchronicity. Is that an accident? I'm not thinking so.
Yeah, there was no need whatsoever. I mean, there was no need for the war, but.
There was no need for the
that we needed to win the war. What are you bringing the Soviet Union in?
Yeah, right. A lot of people believe that there was no need for the atomic bomb, that the atomic bomb was used as
they were trying to surrender through the Soviets, using the Soviets as a third party. And Stalin's like, oh, okay, well, we'll see what we could do. We'll talk to them. Okay. Little did they know that he already signed on to attack Japan 90 days after VE Day. So you talk about treachery. So they show up. The war's over. They don't even get bloodied or dirtied. What do? They collect the weapons from the Japanese. Mm-hmm. Then they get their excess lend-lease supply weapons that they were getting from Roosevelt. They don't need them now. War's over. What do with them? They give them to Mao. Okay? And that Chinese Civil War resumes.
And guess what? And you know, there was and I got this from reading L. Fletcher Prouty. There was a boatload of munitions that were coming from Europe that were no longer in need, and they were put on a boat to come to Burma to fly over the hump for the American forces that were supporting Chiang Kai-shek to fly over the hump, and because that's what. That was what L. Fletcher Prouty was. He was a pilot. He flew over the hump. And he said that that communique came in and they had to dump all those weapons at sea to make sure that they could not get those weapons to Chiang Kai-shek to fight Mao.
Yeah. And then later on, Korean War, that's why they wanted to get rid of MacArthur. MacArthur wanted to hook up with Chiang Kai-shek again. Mm-hmm. So now he's on Taiwan. And like they wouldn't arm Chiang Kai-shek. So now they wanted Chiang out. And he was gone a few years after the end of World War II, 1949, fled to Taiwan, totally betrayed by the communists in the Roosevelt administration, which then became the Truman administration. All those people that Joe McCarthy was talking about. So that they did it exactly what I was talking about. Before going back to the 30s, pit China, nationalist China and nationalist Japan against each other, take them down both, just like they did the Tsar and the Kaiser after World War II. That's how they do. And that's how Mao took over and brutalized that that island, that, I mean, that nation. So, and then, of course, with these two anti-communist powers of nationalist China and nationalist Japan out of business, the cancer
communists had a free hand.
From Stalin to Mao, Korean War, that was Yalta too, the division of North Korea and South Korea. And they gave Stalin temporary jurisdiction over North Korea. So there's your Korean War. And then your Vietnam War. So
was that Yalta or Tehran? Was that Yalta or Tehran?
The partition of Korea.
Some of that was Tehran, because yeah. and the crappy thing, or the shitty thing is that Chiang Kai-shek was there. Chiang Kai-shek represented the Chinese delegation at Tehran, and the reason I know that is because, again, L. Fletcher Prouty flew him.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they would have been able to make that deal while he was there. I'm thinking it's Yalta, but
they could have made it behind closed doors.
Yeah, could be. I mean, because you know the kind of they might have been able to squeeze them by that time, because they could say, listen, we could reactivate the Reds. And eventually, they did.
Yeah. So, well, if you look at the United Nations, the original fifth country of United Nations was nationalist China, but then I think it was it 1971 or 72 when they changed to communist China.
What's that?
And I'm talking about the United Nations, because in United Nations, you have the Security Council, which is the five nations, China, France, England, Russia, and United States. Well, the first iteration of the United Nations was nationalist China, but I think it was either 1961 or 1971 or something like that when they recognized communist China as the mm-hmm. member of the fifth member of the Security Council.
Right. Yeah, that's probably, yeah, they didn't do that right away. It sounds like it would be the 60s.
I actually think it was more of the 70s when Nixon was president. Yeah, because
it's Yalta. It says here at Yalta, they made the deal to split up Korea. So at Yalta, they gave Stalin Eastern Europe, and they gave him the foothold in Asia.
Gotcha.
As well. Sickening. Totally unnecessary. And it's just one war led to the other. It would have never had the spread of communism in Asia if Japan was in power. You know?
And I just got done reading your book, I Don't Like Ike. And I think I was telling you that I came across that passage where it talked about how when Eisenhower took over, he had to shut the door on the Korean conflict. And had to do it rapidly. And as a result, he left over 1,000 guys in North Korea.
Yep. Yes, he did. He also abandoned American POWs who had come under the control of the Soviets after World War II, because they liberated mm-hmm. them from German camps. And a lot of those people disappeared as well. So, you know, when they finish these wars, they don't want these annoying little loose ends. All right, you know, hanging out there, POW. So just write them off. Just write them off. So, yeah, of course, Eisenhower, he not only abandoned those POWs in Korea, but he immediately began positioning for the next war in Vietnam. He was the one who sent the advisors there. Advisors, CIA. And out of that presence that JFK wanted to end, is how it eventually grew into the Vietnam War. So that's how they do it. They finish one war and they're like pool players. They make their shot and they position the cue ball in such a manner that they're ready for the next war. And then the next one. And the American people never catch on. Always the same trick. Just put a flag in their hand and off you go. And nobody ever paused to reflect, why are we at war again in Korea? Why are we at war in Vietnam? It really wasn't that hard to puzzle out back then, because everybody lived through the end of World War II. So, you know, you'd think there'd be some kind of uprising in this country. And actually there was, but they suppressed it. You know, they did the McCarthy. Then they smeared the John Birch Society. They turned the big guns of the media against you. So, and this is why, you know, World War II is so destructive in so many ways, all the shit that came out of it, and still to this day.
It's reprehensible when you really think about it, that, I give you credit for this, for, you know, basically bracing my mind to realize that World War II, the ultimate ending of World War II, was the foundation to which the New World Order spawned from. That that we weren't fighting on the good side; we were actually fighting on the bad side. We were fighting on the side of world government.
Yes,
and people didn't realize it. It was they were fooled into believing that, you know, we were actually fighting a good war.
Right.
And it's disgusting to think that. And, you know, and then look at the guys that fought in Korea. Those are pretty much forgotten men. Most people don't even know that we had a Korean conflict. Mm-hmm. And then but everybody knows about Vietnam. And, you know, and then, hey, same thing. Then, you know, we left all those POWs over there. McCain didn't want to have any reason to bring those guys back. He actually did what he could to prevent them from coming back.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's just the same old story over and again. And then, of course, when the United States realized, because of all the crap that they were doing against the Soviet Union, even though they were funding them behind the scenes, but they were working politically against them in the world, those successes caused them to go bankrupt. And basically caused them to cease to exist. And then that was the whole reason that they were preparing for radical Islam to be the new enemy in the 1970s, was to begin to build up a military presence in the Middle East that we could ultimately parlay into if we had to fight with, Russian forces in Central Asia. Nobody wants to, you know, put those points together and paint that picture, because they don't like the way that it looks. But that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Well, that's been the story, and it's only really coming to an end now. You know, it really is. And that is what the Q military operation was all about, is stopping this, putting an end to it. Mm-hmm. And I believe they have. And I think right now we're in the home stretch of the public revelations will be coming soon. But this is something I wish more Q people were more well steeped in, because then, you know, you just have a clearer picture. That's why I wrote this book, Crash Course NWO, 250 Years of the Globalist Conspiracy in Just 1 Hour.
Yep.
It's not going to make you an expert, of course, but it's a basic framework. And I take you from the 1800s all the way through the world wars up until today. This is on Amazon. You can get this on Amazon, by the way. It helps my rankings. Amazon Crash Course NWO. And you will see clearly, unambiguously, the direct line, this cabal from the late 1700s through the days of Napoleon, 19th century, the world wars right up to 9/11 until today. So it's an amazing story, but throughout... there was no bigger event in that 250-year span than World War II. And it's really kind of World War I is World War Part One, and World War II is World War Part Two.
Right.
That did lay the foundations for the modern world that we, all suffered under. And it would have come to an end, a very unhappy ending, had Hillary, Madam President, gotten in there. Because that's what her task would have been. To finally close out this drama and institute the one world tyrannical system. So,
well, I think, And I think it's partially true that there was a couple of attempts to generate that Third World War in the 1960s. You know, the failed Bay of Pigs. Then you had the the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then you had the Six-Day War.
Northwoods? Remember Operation Northwoods?
That was before.
JFK probably saved us from World War III. Mm-hmm. Put the kibosh on Operation Northwoods.
Yep.
He did not escalate after Bay of Pigs, which is what they wanted him to do. Okay. He fired that what's his name? Lemnitzer.
Lemnitzer. And of course,
Dulles. I mean,
you know where Lemnitzer went.
Bad hombres, man. That Eisenhower left in place.
You know where Lemnitzer went immediately after being there. He went over to NATO. He got fired, but then didn't he get put into the position of commander of NATO forces?
Yeah, these guys I'm almost positive. They always land on their feet.
Even though he fired Dulles, there was bureaucratic resistance, and people still followed Dulles's orders, even though Dulles was at home.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then of course you had LBJ with the USS Liberty. I think the Russians might have saved this from World War III because it's my understanding that the only reason the Israelis called off the attack is it was a Russian ship in the area.
There was a Russian nuclear submarine that had targeted the Dome of the Rock.
Yeah. When? During the Liberty?
Yeah. The USS America and the Saratoga literally had launched. There were Marines in the water going towards Gaza, and then there were aircraft in the air carrying nuclear bombs that were going to bomb Cairo, and they called it off and scuttled that mission and brought them all back to base because the Russians were there and were targeting the Dome of the Rock, and if the United States dropped those weapons on Cairo, they were gonna nuke Dome of the Rock.
Oh wow, yeah, 60s were bad times. That's what Eisenhower left us with. We caught a couple breaks, bought some time, but then the latest pushed. You know, the Bush, Cheney, Obama era, just setting everything up to have that confrontation with Russia. And you might still appear that we're going to go to war with Russia if they play that card, but it's going to be fake. It's going to be all under the Q operation.
I don't believe that at all.
Everything's been deactivated, defused by Trump and Putin.
I don't know how much of China is bad. I don't know. Because there are definitely evil elements within China, but I think there's good elements within China fighting that. You know, China has its own deep state, just like Russia had its own deep state. But I think the Russian deep state has pretty much for the most part been neutralized. And the two countries that have their own deep state that are fighting it in the most open right now are the United States and China.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But you know, who knows? We're gonna see. You know. I look at this, like you said, as a scare event. I remember there was the cue drop when he put the video clip of when the day the Earth stood still, and it's like, you're humans, you're not gonna change. And I said, no, it's like we won't change right until we get right to the precipice,
right?
And that's when we'll change, and that's what we're gonna have to see, is we're gonna have to get right up to that precipice. So anyway, any final words there? We are over the 1 hour mark there, Mr. King. Any final words?
No, that's it. You know, the usual, visit realnewsandhistory.com. Get on the mailing list. realnewsandhistory.com/Ron. If you want the books, purchase any of the books, you get like a special offer. But this is the homework assignment. If you really want to get up to speed in 1 hour, go to Amazon, Crash Course NWO. I'm pushing this one here. Crash Course 9/11 Inside Job is blowing up on Amazon.
Really?
Good, yeah.
That's awesome news.
It is. Things are. I'm telling you, things are loosening up. I'm not gonna push it and put my World War II and my Holocaust stuff on there. But they are allowing controversial stuff back on. And the new boss even said we're against censorship. You know, how far they'll go, I don't know. But it's gotten a lot better. As is YouTube, is what I understand. So.
Yeah. All righty, gentlemen. Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. King, for tonight. And ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoy your evening. And Mike and I will be back next Tuesday night. Do we have anything kind of on our plate, or have we decided on something?
Let's see what happens. You know, come up with something, or maybe this week we'll bring some events, unfolding events that we should discuss. I know we have the first.
I think what might be a good idea is for you to kind of do a rough overdraft of the war on Putin. Maybe just do some highlights on the war on Putin, because I think that's a relevant topic right now, I think.
Yeah.
So maybe we make that a two-parter, because there's a lot there. But, oh, sure. But anyway, that's just my thought. So
okay.
So, all right, guys. Well, if that comes to fruition, that's what we'll have. That's what it will be next week. Otherwise, we may come up with something different. We'll see we'll see what happens during the week. Until next time, we will see you when we see you. Have a good night, everybody.